Listen and stream the only talk radio, Freedom 106.5, for the only talk that matter.
Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago, and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. It's Carrie V in your company going all the way to 12 noon. And we're going to jump straight into Doctors on Call, which we do every Tuesdays with Dr. Nadira Rambukas. Good morning, Dr. Rambukas. And how are you?
Good morning, Cara. Good morning, Dr. Jerome Phillip. It's Thursday, Cara, not Tuesday.
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
Something good morning, wrong? Dr. Rambukas. Good morning, Cara.
Morning, Dr. Phillip. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad, actually. It's nice to be living back in a sunny country.
Nice.
So I wanted to introduce Dr. Jerome Phillip a little bit so our listeners will have an idea about his specialty. He is a UK-trained oral and maxillofacial surgeon with a special interest in head and neck cancer microvascular reconstruction. He qualified in both medicine and dentistry from the University of the West Indies. Postgraduate, he holds fellowship diplomas in oral maxillofacial surgery from the Royal College of Surgeons, Edinburgh, as well as oral surgery, oral medicine from the Faculty of Dentistry, Ireland, and a diploma in cancer studies from University of Newcastle. Dr. Jerome's basic oral and maxillofacial training was on East Anglia rotation that contains a world-famous Cambridge University Hospital, Addenbrookes. That is the location. He was Edinburgh's first international head and neck microvascular fellow to be awarded their fellowship certificate. He is an examiner for the FFD RCSI specialty exam for oral surgery and medicine Ireland. He was the head and neck cancer lead for Humber in East Yorkshire. He is an oral maxillofacial surgeon trainer, also an interface trainer for plastic surgery, and was on throat for post-specialist head and neck fellowship training for the East Yorkshire Surgical Deanery. So quite an extensive curriculum vitae, I must say. So we want to welcome.
And it's nice to be invited onto your program.
So, Dr. Jerome, you've been studying for a long time. Why did you choose medicine?
I think it's the usual Trinidadian thing, really. Growing up, it's very few jobs that you could have. It's either become a lawyer, a doctor. I don't think sports people were very popular in our days of school, really. So once you got the grades, you went into medical school or law school. I don't think law was for me because it entailed a lot of reading, and history wasn't one of my favorite subjects. I was more of a science kind of math person. So yeah, after A-levels, I applied to UWI and both medicine and dentistry. And funny enough, my first thoughts were, I can't really do the on-calls. You know, I really love to have a job from 9 to 5, really. So that's how I ended up doing dentistry first. Roughly, I'd say about year 3 in dentistry, we had an old professor called Professor Thompson, and he was basically an oral maxillofacial surgeon, quite old school, English trained, and one of the first operations I saw him do is take off this tumor from the upper jaw, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. And after chatting with him, he explained to me the way that MaxFax or maxillofacial surgery was going was it needs to be doubly qualified because you're actually doing more extensive surgery than dental surgery. So he advised to go back to medical school. So that's why I ended up back in medical school back in 2001, I think it was, and then graduated in 2004.
Okay, great. So you've been studying like most of your life. What is like the motivation for choosing specifically oral maxillofacial surgery? Is it something in particular you liked, or was there a mentor you had?
Yeah, I had two main mentors, really. One was a guy called Professor Matthews, who got me into the UK, but a very close and dear friend was Dr. Scipio, who is actually an American-trained MaxFax surgeon. And I mean, most people will know Dr. Scipio locally, and he mentored me through dental school. He's a very close friend of the family. Oddly enough, he went to school with my stepfather. They were the same year in school and all that stuff, you know. And he was such a gentle person. And, you know, just seeing what he did, how he dealt with patients, I think especially his demeanor in terms of how he actually bonded with his patients, really, that really touched me. And I think growing into maxillofacial surgery and trying to help people cancer surgery was on top of my list, because cancer surgery, once done properly, you can have very good outcomes. So that's how I ended up in cancer surgery itself, because I want to make a difference in people's lives.
So let's talk a little bit about head and neck cancers. Are they common in Trinidad and Tobago, and how often do they occur?
Well, excellent question. Globally, believe it or not, head and neck cancers is the sixth most popular cancer on a global scale. In more developed countries, it goes lower down the ladder, because most of the times, head and neck cancer is driven specifically by environmental habits, the smoking, the drinking, okay? In Trinidad, it follows a global pattern. It's roughly about 4 people per 3,000. So if you extrapolate that into hard numbers, there are roughly about 2,000 people living with oral cancer as we speak. And on a yearly basis, there's roughly about 230 people diagnosed, newly diagnosed with cancer every single year. I think the difficulty about coming back home to Trinidad, a lot of people wait until very late. So most cancers in Trinidad present late. So unfortunately, the chance of cure is a lot lower, and the surgeries are functionally debilitating, really. But oral cancers are quite common. We're seeing a lot of them now in a dental school, since we're trying to actually have a specialized head and neck clinic. What we do see, a lot of what we call squamous cell carcinomas of the tongue, floor of mouth, cheeks, and so forth. But yes, there are different other types of oral cancer. They can arrive from salivary glands. They can arrive from the structures within the lips, the nose, and the maxillary cavity, and of course the eyes, really.
Right. Why do persons in Trinidad and Tobago present so late?
I think it's a cultural thing. So first things first, I think in Trinidad, people often think about their families first. So most of the times I'll get, especially the middle-aged woman who has relatively big families, you know, most of the times I say, oh, they have their son to take to school, they have the lunch to cook, you know, family to look after. And unfortunately, this was the only time I could come and see you. So I think it's a cultural thing in terms of people and how they relate to their jobs and so forth. The other thing is, especially among Trinidadian males, I think it's an absolute fear of coming to the doctor or the dentist, a fear of being diagnosed with cancer, one. So, yep, you know, I think one of the main things that when they do get diagnosed with cancer is, am I going to die? So I think it's trying to delay what sometimes they think is the inevitable. But again, it's completely the flip side of things. I mean, you come in early and you have a small cancer, there's a 99% chance of cure once it's caught early.
Right. Is there a predominance for these type of cancers for a particular sex or race?
Right. It just depends. So oral squamous cell cancer, on a global scale, it's more predisposed to males rather than females, because those are the guys, I guess, you see more at the rum shop drinking and punching and smoking the cigarettes, while the females don't really engage in such activities, really. But in the more developed countries, for example, the UK and the Americas, you know, where smoking has decreased quite a bit because they have laws in terms of where you can smoke, taxes on cigarettes making the prices quite high, taxes on alcohol making prices quite high. What they've seen a narrowing of that gap, where male to female oral cancers almost back down to 1-to-1. Besides for oral cancer, there's another type of cancer called oropharyngeal cancer. And the oropharyngeal cancer are those cancers which are further back, for example, the tongue soles, the throat, the vocal cords, and so forth. And that kind of cancer is actually driven by the HPV virus, or what you call the human papillomavirus. The human papillomavirus is sexually transmitted. Unfortunately, it's the same virus that drives cervical cancer. So what we are seeing is that people who actually participate in oral sex and so forth, they do get HPV-driven oral cancers. Oddly enough, we're now starting to do studies in the UK, Australia, Canada, and papers are coming out because there was a big drive about 20 years ago to vaccinate young girls with the HPV vaccine. And they have noted a big decrease in HPV-driven oropharyngeal cancers, so much so that the Canadians especially, they're actually advocating HPV vaccine for boys as well. I don't think we've reached that far in Trinidad in terms of getting an HPV vaccine generally for school-age ladies, but it's food for thought for our gods that be, really.
So for these particular type of cancers, how do patients normally present? Like, what symptoms would they have? What do they have to look out for?
Okay, so it all depends on where the cancer is. So, for example, lip cancer is usually a white patch on the lip. Non-healing ulcer can be quite painful. Within the oral cavity, the most common site of SCC or squamous cell carcinoma is the tongue, lateral borders of the tongue. And again, the main thing for the public to look at is if they have an ulcer on the inside of the mouth, on the side of the tongue, floor of mouth, and is either getting bigger or is not healing over 2 weeks, see a dentist. Make sure you see a dentist, okay? The ones further back, like, for example, the base of tongue where you can't see, or the tongue soles, you do get pain. You do get signs and symptoms of difficulty swallowing or painful swallowing. But most of the times, I actually present to my ENT colleagues with a lump in the neck. So never ignore any kind of funny lumps and bumps in your neck, so because that may also be a sign of something that's happening within the mouth or the back of your throat. If you go further down to the vocal cords and so forth, hoarseness of voice, change of voice, that is a very alarming symptom.
Right. So how can these patients normally be screened besides seeing their dentist? Is there any way they can prevent these cancers? As in, is there any screening, like they should visit their dentist every 6 months, or they should probably check out an nose and throat doctor if they notice any abnormal bumps or difficulty in swallowing or chewing?
No, absolutely. The first stop really should be a GP. If you have anything that's of concern to you, any new lesions on the lip, inside the mouth, see a GP. The lovely part about public health was roughly about 30, 40 years ago. And even when I first came back home, there was the drive for breast cancer. And young ladies came on screen, very prominent young ladies who were part of the radio host shows and so forth, you know. Going down to Brian Lara, you know, showing people how to feel their breasts, you know, going for mammograms and so forth. You know, it's actually quite simple. So a simple drive, a simple awareness, saying, okay, fine. You know, when you're brushing your teeth, you have bleeding gums, and also that is painful, that's not healing. Go and see a doctor, go and see a dentist, let them have a look at it, make sure that they're happy. Worst case scenario, they may want to take a small sample of the tissue to look under the microscope just to see what it is. And again, the whole thing about it is to be more preventative rather than reactive, really. So small lesions mean smaller operations, you know, meaning a higher chance of cure. So I think it starts from the basics for us as medical practitioners. And for example, exactly what you're doing now, simple educating the public, you know, by saying, okay, fine, all right, oral cancers, small ulcers in the mouth, have a look at it, go and see the dentist, go and see the ENT. If it's something on your face, for example, a mole that's changing in color, a mole that's changing size, has become itchy, a dermatologist or a plastic surgeon, you know, those are little things that we can actually start making patients aware of, really.
Docs, we have a question from someone via WhatsApp. The person says, good morning, doctor. Good morning, Carrie V. My daughter is 10 and she ever so often gets a related blister or ulcer on her tongue. Should I see a doctor or should I see a dentist?
Oh, very good question. All right, so it's the oral cavity is completely alien to most general practitioners. I think a dentist would be the most appropriate person to see with these, because dental surgeons are usually trained in oral medicine, oral pathology. The recurring lesions, especially in a 10-year-old, is unlikely to be anything sinister, but usually stress-related. But definitely go and see a dentist first. Let them have a look at it, see what the ulcer is like. And again, simple things can actually help.
Another question as well. Someone says that they have been experiencing a burning sensation in their throat. I'm experiencing a burning sensation in my throat for about 2 weeks. I went to my doctor and they told me that I had a throat infection and gave me antibiotics. Somehow, after the 5 days, I still have that pain in my throat. Can you tell me if it's cancer related or what should I do?
Well, it's a very difficult question, that one. Well, most of the times when you have changes like that, it's cancer itself is quite rare, okay? So you go through the normal steps first in terms of trying to diagnose. So yes, okay, fine. If the doctor thinks it's an infection, start with antibiotics, it hasn't worked. The right thing to do is actually go back through the whole treatment scheme, really. You know, is this pain at night? Is it when he lies down? Is this reflux? You know, does he drink lots of coffee? Does he drink eats lots of chocolate, red wine, and so forth? So it's a whole host of things that can cause a burning sensation at the back of the throat. So unfortunately, if you've seen his GP, antibiotics are not working, it's probably best his GP goes back to his GP, you know, explain to him. And probably see a specialist, whether it's a gastroenterologist or ENT surgeon, to put a scope down to see what's happening. So that's probably the best way to go, to see his GP again and probably get a referral to a specialist.
Thank you, doctor. Guys, don't forget you can call us. You can ask the doctor any questions related to your throat or your head. We are talking about neck cancer, head cancer, with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. Jerome Phillip. It's just about 9:20. Our numbers are 627-3223, 625-2257. You can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065.
Dr. Jerome, as we were talking about oral and head and neck cancers, what are the treatment options that are available for these types of cancers? Do we stage them and then do we perform a procedure?
Okay, excellent. So when you see a specialist, or there's ENT, maxillofacial, or plastics, the first stage is a diagnosis. So what tends to happen, we take a small sample of the ulcer or the growth, look under the microscope. Now, most of the times with cancer, there is a process, as you quite rightly said, so we do stage the cancers. So we want to know whether the cancer is just locally, whether what we're seeing, that's it. So clinical examination, whereby we feel the neck, feel under the armpits, feel behind the head, look in the scalp, and we supplement that with scans, and we tend to get a CT scan of the whichever cavities involved, a CT scan of the regional area. So with head and neck, we get a CT scan of the neck, along with a CT scan of the chest, because those are the three most common sites for head and neck cancers to go to, really. Once we come up with a staging, we have an idea of the chance of cure, and that's when we sit down and speak to patients, saying it's a stage one, stage two, or stage four, and usually, depending about the size of the lesion, the regional spread, or even distance spread, we talk about chances of cure. That's when we go into different treatment, different treatment modalities. Now, oral facial cancer, unfortunately, does not respond very well to chemoradiotherapy alone. And if you look at the literature, oral cancer, sinonasal cancer, the highest chance of cure is with surgery plus or minus adjuvant therapy, whether it's chemo, radiotherapy, or a matter of chemo and radiotherapy. So depending on the kind of cancer, whether it's a squamous cell cancer, which is the most common oral cancer, whether it's a cancer arising from the salivary glands, or whether it's one of those weird and wonderful sarcomas whereby it's of a different basic origin, the main form of treatment is surgical, where unfortunately we'll have to take the cancer out, okay? The difficulty is that with your face and mouth, it's something that people seize. It's the first thing that you start relating to patients. It's how you speak, it's how you feed, and it's what people see first. So the main concept behind it is not just taking the cancer out, but to have patients functionally reconstructed so that they don't have to look at themselves in the mirror every single day and be reminded of this horrible disease that they had. And on top of that is for them to get back to as normal as a functional life as possible. The good thing is that as you go further back, for example, tongue soles, throat, vocal cords, the cancers themselves become more and more responsive to chemo-RT, especially those driven by the HPV virus. So the single modality treatment of chemo or chemo-RT for what they call oropharyngeal cancers, they will be the main modality of treatment for them. So it depends on the site of the cancer, and it depends on the type of cancer. It was what treatments will offer most people.
We are getting a call, doctors. Let's take this one. I'm sorry about that. Call me back. 627-3223, 625-2257. You can even send me a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. This is Doctors on Call. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning, Doc. And good morning to your guest, Dr. Good morning, Harry.
Morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, Arima. You're saying that the positioning of the thyroid, is that close to the throat or the neck or something?
The thyroid? Thyroid?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any connection with cancer and thyroid and other ailments coming out from not properly functioning thyroid? Because I can tell you that I have been suffering that for a little while. And one of the symptoms is lack of appetite. So I don't know if you can explain it in a little more detail. I'll listen up first. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. If there's a correlation between the thyroid and any cancer?
Well, yeah. Well, unfortunately, once you have any structure within the body, you know, cells can go bad. Okay. So your thyroid gland, unfortunately, is also one of those glands where you have multiple different types of cells. Because you have multiple different types of cells, there are multiple different types of cancers, whether it's papillary or follicular and so forth. Now, your thyroid is one of the glands which produces thyroxine, and thyroxine is one of those hormones which control metabolic rate and so forth. So yes, you can get either hypo or hypothyroidism depending on the type of cancer that you have, and you can get systemic manifestations of it, okay? And again, usually when you have a diagnosis of a thyroid issue, they tend to look at various components of it. So it's a bit more complex than just your thyroid itself, because you also have a gland called a pituitary gland, which actually produces a hormone which tells your thyroid gland to produce. So it's a few things which your general practitioner will have to look into in a diagnosis of thyroid disease, you know. So it's not just your thyroxine, but it's your thyroxine stimulating hormone produced by another gland and so forth. So yes, one, to answer this question, you can't have cancer in a thyroid gland, and two, you can have systemic manifestations of thyroid cancer. And then three is a bit more complex than just looking at the thyroid gland. You have to look at other things as well.
Right. Now, I know we have to jump straight into a break after this one, but someone sent a message. Good morning, doctors. Good morning, Carrie V. Every night, my tongue feels swollen, and I just want to know what type of mouthwash to use, because when I use a mouthwash, a particular mouthwash, it burns my tongue. So I have to dilute it in water, and then my tongue goes down. I've never been to the doctor to see about it, because after rinsing my mouth with the mouthwash, it usually goes down. Can you tell me, or can I get some advice as to what may cause the swelling of my tongue in the night?
Again, that's a very complex question. There are many different causes of tongue swelling, whether it's an allergic reaction, whether So there's even something called angioedema, where patients actually develop the intermittent swelling, you know. So it's something that I can't just diagnose on a radio show, unfortunately. It's something that you need to go and see your GP about or your dentist about. Let them have a look at the tongue. But she basically put in a very good point. I don't think there are any mouthwashes there out there that should not be diluted. They all should be diluted. You know, most of the times a 50% mouthwash and then you use it. So mouthwashes can be very caustic in terms of, she's right, it burns. Okay, me personally, you know, if I do have an issue with my mouth, I tend to use warm salt water rinses. But mouthwashes, yes, diluted mouthwashes, because it can burn generally.
Wow. All right. Thank you, guys. It's just about 9:28. We've got to take a break. When we come back, it's much more. This is Doctors on Call on Freedom 106.5 FM.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
Good morning and welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM. It's just about 32 minutes after 9. Don't forget you can call us 627-3223, 625-2257, and you can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. You're in Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas, and we are on call with Dr. Jerome Philip. Now, I can't pronounce this word properly here, doctors. Maxillofacial surgeon, right? Oral maxillofacial surgeon. Am I correct?
Yes, no, that's absolutely correct.
Ding, ding, ding.
That's maxillo. Facial comes from the Greek meaning jaws.
Right.
So when you say maxillofacial, it means just jaw surgeons.
I learned a new medical word today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Dr. Philip, I just wanted to ask one final thing. After patients have surgery for various oral cancers, pharyngeal cancers, do we have speech therapy available, physiotherapy available, so that patients can learn how to, especially for cancers of the tongue, if you remove part of the tongue so that they could articulate and swallow and chew properly?
Thank you so much for that question. I think coming back to Trinidad, one of the things I was acutely aware of is, one, do I have the resources, and not just the resources at hand to perform the operation, but then the auxiliary part of it, as you so quite rightly said. In the UK where I trained, we had an occupational therapist, so it's to assist in getting back patients to daily function. We had a speech therapist to aid with the... And it's not just speech. What speech and language do, they also help patients to learn to swallow as well, you know, in terms of the different qualities of food that they can eat, as well as help them with speech. And then we had an onc psychologist. And it's very important because the difficult thing about head and neck surgery and head and neck reconstruction is it's visible. The visible scars, the visible deformities, it doesn't always go completely to plan. You know, yes, you take somebody's jaw out, you want to put back in something to heal the person and make sure that they look fine. But sometimes you do have complications, and that's where you need that whole adjunctive team. To answer your question, we are trying to build a team in terms of trying to get speech and language to join the head and neck team so that we can facilitate. One of my patients was actually looking into getting assistance from University of Chicago, who we are in cahoots with at the moment, in terms of developing nurses and so forth to train them up to learn to help people speak and swallow again. I'm still struggling as well in terms of getting a group together, because I think what's important, especially with head and neck cancer survivors, as with any cancer survivors, is having a network whereby they can get support with each other, knowing what each other have been through. And especially in the moments when things don't go as well as you expect, to have that someone next to you to say, hey, well, come up, you know, I've been through this, we can get through this together. So it's not just a speech and language. I think it's a whole group that we're looking to get into place. And I hope that I'm getting the traction from my other colleagues that this is not a one-man show. It's something that we need to work together for the benefit of all patients, really.
Yeah. We are getting a call, doctors. Let's see who's there. Hi, good morning. You're live?
I'm live on...
You're live on Freedom 106? Doctors on call?
Yes. Good morning to the doctor.
Hello.
You, Dr. Rambokas.
Hi.
What is... I don't know if the doctor can explain to me what a CPV means.
CPZ?
CPV?
I think HPV.
HPV.
Yes.
On a blood test where your platelets are not big, are not forming big.
HCV. Oh, all right. I got you. Okay, you're talking about blood work. Right, so that's a corpuscle volume, really. And it's not just your platelets. It looks at your... Dr. Rambokas, she's taking me back to medical school days. it's pretty much the size of the...
MCV, she means, which is mean corpuscular volume. It's normally the size of your red blood cells. I'm not sure if she's mixing up the different types of blood cells. So your red blood cells is normally between 80 to 96, what we call femtoliters. Anything below 80 is considered microcytosis, or small. Anything above 96 is called macrocytosis, or big. So you're mixing up platelets. Platelets also have a second.
I'm mixing it up, the name.
Yes.
Exactly. But does that mean that you've got a cancer?
No, not necessarily. The most common causes for that is different types of anemia. You know, so usually what we look at your blood level, and then whether or not it's low or not, we then look at the HCV, and as Dr. Rambokas was saying, is whether it's a big cell anemia or small cell anemia. And then the difference between will point us to further investigate the possible causes behind it. All right, I don't really want to frighten people, but yes, sometimes like people who have colon cancer and so forth, where you're losing blood, you can have anemias secondary to chronic blood loss due to these cancers, you know. But you know, I think it needs to be investigated properly before we jump to conclusions, really.
Okay, and doctor, if I take up your time, one more. Sometimes it's very odd. I would just say just like that. And I have a fused neck. It fused naturally before the doctors could have fused it. I suddenly get a pain, a strange kind of feeling on both arms, going down both arms. They just feel numb, and I get an odd pain. I just can't describe it, but it doesn't last very long. But it comes on just suddenly. I don't know if you know anything about that, if anybody has ever spoken or if you've ever come across it.
Yeah, well, from judging from what you're saying, you have cervical spondylosis. But again, pain itself has different qualities and quantities. If you tell me you have cervical spondylosis and getting a burning pain going on the arm, that's normal. However, if you tell me you have pain with numbness, you know, you probably may have to look at a vascular problem as well. So again, it's something that you probably will have to get investigated properly, to tell you honest truth, because, yep, you can't have cervical spondylosis, but you can't have another cause for that pain going down the arm. And by the way, is this your... I hope it's not your left arm.
It's both arms. It just comes on both arms. It just makes both arms feel numb, not in just one. It just like both arms just feel like it's dropping, and it's very painful, and it does not last very long, and then it goes. I don't know what causes it. I am a rheumatoid patient, so.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, and that's a very difficult condition to live with, because my mom had rheumatoid, you know, it can be very painful. But I think before you just write it off to cervical spondylosis, I think you should get a check to make sure your blood vessels around that area works as well.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Thank you so much. You have a message on WhatsApp. Someone says, this guy, he says he's 63 years old, and I've noticed recently, like about 3 weeks, my mouth feels dry. When I spoke to my wife about it, she says it's something natural and normal. But now listening to your program, I want to ask doctor, should I be concerned for a dry mouth?
Yeah, that's another thing. There are many causes of dry mouth. So usually my kind of algorithm for it is to go through your rheumatic system, whether or not you have painful joints, whether or not you have something called psoriasis on your skin, whether or not you have dry eyes associated with it as well. There's a condition called Sjögren syndrome, whereby it is predominantly a primarily dry mouth, but then you could have primary, whereby you just have a dry mouth, or you could have secondary, whereby it's actually precipitated by various other things and usually tend to be rheumatological in nature in terms of it, you know. Or it could just be something quite simple as that you're stressed out and you have anxiety, you know. So it's something, again, you should go check your GP, have a chat, you know, see exactly what's happening to salivary glands, see whether these salivary glands are actually manufacturing saliva, and then go from there, really.
Okay, we get on the next call. Hi, good morning, you're live.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have an 8-year-old daughter, and every time the Sahara dust and so they out, she traveling with tonsil. What can I use for her?
So first things first, tonsils is more my ENT colleague's domain. And when you say suffering from tonsils, is this enlarged, painful tonsils?
Hello?
Hi, yes, you're still on?
Is this enlarged, painful tonsils that she's having?
No, it's not enlarged.
Okay, so when you say suffering from tonsils, I don't understand.
No, the tonsils are swelling in her throat.
Okay, well, right. So basically, tonsils swelling are usually either secondary to a virus or a bacteria, really. And if it's problematic, i.e. she's getting more than 3 episodes per year, she's being hospitalized with antibiotics, really and truly she needs her tonsils out, you know. So my advice to you is go and see one of my ENT colleagues. And go from there, really.
Okay, and doc, and next thing, I take the vaccine, and since I take the vaccine, my 2 feet start to swell, and then a big spot come out of my belly, a big black spot.
The vaccine is nothing, I wouldn't be able to comment on that, but thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you so much. We have another call. Hi, good morning, you're live.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, not a problem.
The flip side of that dry mouth is excessive saliva in one's mouth. What you see a specialist or gastroenterologist, either or. It's an answer.
Thank you so much. For excess saliva, if to see a gastroenteritis or...
Oh, okay. Excess saliva. Again, that's a funny one, you know, because you can, even something like having really bad teeth, you know, rotten teeth, gum disease and so forth can actually cause you to actually produce excess saliva, you know. So again, it's something that he probably needs to start off by going to see his GP, let the GP have a look in his mouth, then probably may have to go and see the dentist, get his teeth cleaned up and all that stuff. If it's not suffering, you probably have to go and see an ENT, look behind his throat, make sure there's nothing kind of irritating. And then, yeah, I mean, if he does have signs of reflux, you know, you can't have excess saliva being produced, especially at night. So, again, it's a very complex combination of things, really.
Docs, we get a lot of calls, right? So I know we have an interview to do, but let's take another one, right? Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning, ma'am. Good morning to the doctors.
Morning.
I'm 57 years of age, strong, that does not use alcohol or smoke cigarette or drugs. December, in the last week, I found myself gapping for breath, and my two legs became weak. I went to do a blood test. They administered to me, my blood count was 4.8, that is HCB. The white one was 2 point something. The other one was 2 point something. I took 3 pints of blood in January. So far, I take 7 pints of blood up to last week. My blood count is keep dropping to 4.8. They did numerous tests, stool tests, every single test you could think about in the system. All I'm getting from these professionals, which they attend to me, very professionals, and they are specialists, hematologists and what have you. All I'm getting from them when I ask what is the problem, they have to do a bone marrow test. When you do it here, they say I have to stay in Miami for 8 days and 2 weeks and come back, and this kind of frustrating me. So I wanted something more concrete with all these tests, because there's a thousands upon thousands upon thousands I spent, and I expected, well, something, tell me cancer, tell me whatever, but it's still dropping back, and I'm not bleeding, I'm not passing blood, I'm not passing blood in the urine, in the stool. I'm driving, they banned me from driving, I'm walking like normal. If you see me, you will say, nah, those reports are negative against me. So I'm off the air, and maybe you could have a little input in me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Well, the first thing I have to say is that I'm sorry to hear that you're having all these problems, you know. The thing, quite honestly, if you're with the hematologist, you're with the right person in terms of trying to diagnose what you have. But I think as the general public, you also have to be patient with us as doctors. I mean, yes, we do have a doctor degree. We do go to dental school and all that stuff. But at the same time, you know, we don't know everything, and they will have different things which will stomp us. And sometimes we have to say we just don't know, but we're looking for it. What you have, unfortunately, is not completely uncommon, and it can be precipitated by something simple as a virus, you know. And there's a term for it, unfortunately. We call it idiopathic, and it's a nice term for saying sometimes we just don't know what's causing us. But, you know, sometimes your body can rectify itself spontaneously. But judging from what you're saying, you are being seen by the right people. Just be patient with them, and just take your time. You know, I think they will eventually get to where they need to get.
Let's take this.
Do you have anything to say about that?
It sounds as though he has something called a pancytopenia. So all the different blood cells are on the low side. So either it's not being manufactured properly, or it's being broken down at some point. And it's just to find where the problem is and treat it appropriately.
Let's take this other call. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Hi, morning, Caribbean. Morning to your guest.
Hey, morning.
I just want to know, is the question of wanting to eat a lot, is that a downside to one's health? Wanting to eat, like you eat breakfast, you eat lunch, and then you might have a early dinner, but then you seem to eat later on in the night. Is there a downside to that regarding one's health? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. Yeah, well, unfortunately, I've been to the doctors myself, and I'm in that funny kind of a thing called pre-diabetic, so I'm not quite diabetic. So what my wife does, she locks the fridge after 9 o'clock. So I don't know if that helps, but yeah, I think the whole thing is just stick to regular meals, really.
All right, Doc, thank you so much.
Sometimes some people metabolism are different, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or probably you're just a little hungry after you eat a little
while. I think I'm quite bad. I'm like that caller. I'll have dinner and then I'll open the fridge and then, oh, there's
cake. That's it, right.
So, I think we have the same problem myself and my caller.
Dr. Philip, we just want to switch gears a little bit. Do you encounter a lot of facial injuries and trauma in your practice?
Yeah, well, right. So in the UK, it's weird because I'm also a military surgeon, a British military surgeon. So we trained in ballistics and so forth, and severe facial reconstruction with microvascular tissue. Oddly enough, because guns are very well regulated in the UK, we really don't see ballistic trauma. So in the UK, I would see motor vehicle accidents, broken jaws, interpersonal violence, and so forth. My job here in Trinidad, I'm really and truly a head neck surgeon. But then when we get the complicated trauma, and oddly enough, it's more ballistic related, you know, people being shot in the face and all that stuff. That's the kind of stuff that I'll tend to get involved with here in Trinidad, you know. So the routine type of mandibular fractures are done by my colleagues is when we have the bigger ones, really. But coming back home, this has been a bit of an eye-opener in terms of how people relate to each other and different types of injuries. And right now we're trying to get a database up and running about the type of facial injuries in Trinidad, because it's different from what I've seen in the UK.
Is it a lot of, say, blunt force trauma or from motor vehicle accidents as opposed to what you witness in the UK?
Lots of motor vehicle accidents. There's a lot more motor vehicle accidents in Trinidad than the UK one. A lot of people just punching each other after a few drinks, as usual. That's quite common, you know. So, yeah.
And how do you assess these patients? Because part of your training is plastic surgery. So is it that we have to maintain the airway and then you appropriately fix or put in prosthesis or wire or...
All right. The maxillofacial trauma, it looks a lot worse than it usually is. So you get this guy come in with half his face falling off because of a bad accident, but usually most of the times they do have a fairly stable airway. If there's any concern, I mean, personally, I think that the guys here at Mount Hope are brilliant. They come through A&E, they get quickly assessed by the A&E doctors. They either get tubed or the ENT surgeons come in quickly, put a tracheostomy in. And then we tend to assess the patient from there. So usually you look at the mechanism of trauma, and the mechanism of trauma will guide you to what's broken or not. Then you do, of course, a clinical examination. So now the trauma patient and the normal clinical patients are two different things. So you go through your whole airway breathing circulation for your trauma patient. For the patient in the clinic, you just do a head-to-toe examination and then a more focused examination of the facial bones, you know. So you look at the eyes, the sockets, the way how the eyes move, whether they have any double vision, whether or not the eyes are at different levels. You look at the nose, nasal bones, look inside the nose just to make sure that the nose apertures are the same. And then, of course, with the jaws themselves, can the patient bite together? You know, because that's the main thing. The most of the times the patient said, "Doc, I've got smack in my face and now I can't bite. My jaw feels off." Or I have numbness, meaning that the nerve itself is damaged, you know. So those are the kind of things that you look for. Now, we have gone a long way from wiring jaws together. So most of the times now we do what they call plating or microplating, whereby we make either incisions on the inside of the jaw or the outside of the jaw, get the jaws in the right place and plate them back into the right place, really, you know. So yeah,
that's great. How often do you encounter like these types of facial trauma and injuries in Trinidad? Is it common?
Well, judging from my colleagues downstairs in the apartment, they say about 2 to 3 a week, so it is fairly common. You know, and sadly enough, so for the last month or the last few weeks, we had about 3 or 4 gunshot injuries, you know, facial gunshot wounds. So it's yeah, unfortunately, it's fairly common.
And do you do the plastic surgery at the same time that you're doing functional revision?
So, right. So again, excellent question. So basically from training, especially with high velocity type trauma, what you tend to do, you tend to make the patient safe, as you quite rightly said. Okay, so make the airway safe and make them fine. So once that's fine, you can sit on the patient for a while. So you make sure that the physiology returns to normal. When I say physiology, meaning that the blood pressure, the pulse and so forth comes back to normal before you can do anything. And that also gives you a chance as well to see what tissue actually is non-vital, meaning dead tissue, and what tissue are alive. Then that guides you to what tissue to take out, and then again, what tissue to put in. In terms of putting tissue back in, we look at local tissue, whether or not you have enough skin from around the face or the head neck area to bring in to reconstruct the area. One of the popular places is from the chest, where you can both bring both skin and muscle in from the chest to reconstruct the head and neck. If that's not possible, and you need other things like, for example, bones or nerve, we have microvascular reconstruction, whereby we could bring piece of people's legs or piece of people's thighs to reconstruct different areas of the face.
Right. Are the prosthesis that we use, are they now MRI compatible, or what is the material that we use?
So in terms of the plates and screws, they're titanium. So yes, so there's no issue putting a patient through an MRI scanner.
Okay. And do they return back to normal after they've had, how long on average do these facial injuries and trauma, do they take to heal? It depends.
So, right. So it usually takes about 6 to 8 weeks to get back to roughly about 70% of a normal strength. And 70% of a normal strength is enough strength to carry on functioning if you don't get hit again. But you usually tell them, do not go back. So like if you're a boxer or you do some kind of contact sport, we actually recommend roughly about 8 to 12 weeks, really. You know, sometimes you still see those footballers with a facial mask. Most of the time they're trying to protect the cheekbone, which is recently plated. But again, if you get £50,000 a week to do that, then happy days. You know, but yeah, most of the times we say, try to rest.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Philip.
Docs, I have a message from someone on WhatsApp. Hi, good morning again. Just wanted to mention with regards to the listener that just called about the platelets and bone marrow issue. I recently had been diagnosed with idiopathic, I don't know how to pronounce this word, right? That word. After seeking advice from Dr. Sophia, who is usually with us, and I was subjected to all the tests he mentioned except the bone marrow, as my body was producing the platelets normally. I'm only 33 years old, and I would like to say it was and still is scary for me, and I'm on treatment currently. So the listener, trust the process and be positive. Also, she was just giving advice to the caller who called about the bone marrow. Yes.
Okay.
I would agree. Trust the process.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Dr. Philip, is there any current publications that you're working on currently?
Yes. So before I left the UK, I was working on something called the submental island flap. And what that does, it's taking skin from just under the chin area to reconstruct the tongue and face, you know. And what I was looking at especially is that, can you safely raise this flap to reconstruct the oral cavity without transferring potential lymph nodes, which can have cancer in it, really. And it was recently published, actually. It's published either this month or last month in the British Journal of Oral Maxillofacial Surgery. And the whole gist behind it is that, yes, you can have lymph nodes, but it's quite rare to transfer lymph nodes. But in terms of the lymph nodes of the transfer, it's no different from actually taking a free flap from anywhere else in the body, really. So that was my latest research. But as with most people during COVID, you know, we did a whole set of papers on the whole progress from face-to-face interviews to telephone interviews and patient satisfactions and so forth, you know. But yeah, you know, most of my publications would be around head and neck cancer, salivary gland cancer, lip cancer, maxillary cancer, and so forth.
Great. And how can you be reached?
All right. So firstly, I work through Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. We are in the process, I shouldn't say we are in the process, we have set up a head neck unit, and I work quite closely with my ENT colleagues. We have a clinic on a Monday morning. And yeah, so it's the head neck stuff is really through Mount Hope, through the oral maxillofacial unit at Mount Hope.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Philip, for being informative, for being educational. Thank you to my co-host, Karen.
Thank you very much. This was very interesting, you know, and I want to thank all the callers, though, for those who are experiencing different things and, you know, they reached out to you. I know you gave your number, you gave your location as well, so you can check him out, Dr. Jerome Philip. for all your oral issues, oral medical issues.
I know you tried to say that.
Yeah, I tried, right? But thank you so much for joining us. I hope on another day we'll be able to join with you again so that you can elaborate more on different issues that people face.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, Dr. Rambuka, see you next time. Same place, same time. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.